Tonight we're going to be focusing on how to help someone who's hurting. What do you say? What words of wisdom can help them? Sometimes we don't say the right things, and our lack of wisdom can actually be hurtful. For instance, a preacher once told a mother who had just lost her son, you know, if you weren't strong enough, God would never let you let this happen to you. I know you can endure it. And the mother, of course, simply didn't understand what that meant. And so she asked, so are you saying if I was weaker, then my son would still be alive? Nothing about that makes sense. Just an illustration of we don't always say the right thing. Obviously, it's very important how we reach out to those who are hurting or grieving. It very well may open the door or close the door to winning a soul. It's either going to strengthen or it's going to weaken the faith of a Christian. Get your Bible and turn to the book of Job. We're going to be primarily just looking at passages in Job. There are things taught in Job that are just as relevant today as they were during the times of the patriarchs when Job lived. But this book teaches us especially how to endure pain, but also how to help and serve those who are in pain. Of course, you know the story. Job was a very wealthy, popular man, and it was only natural that when he lost his wealth and his children, that some friends would come to comfort him. And when his friends arrived, they were shocked by the condition of Job. Look at Job 2, verse 11. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. For they had made an appointment together to come and to mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him, they lifted their voices and wept, and each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. And after 7 days of sitting and mourning with Job, Job finally spoke, and all that he could say was, well, he just cursed the day of his birth. Now, what would you say to Job if you'd been sitting with him for 168 hours and then heard him just curse the day he was born? Oh, it's okay, Job. It'll all work out. That just doesn't seem to fit the bill, right? Or Job, you just need to lean on God. Or Job, God will not put more on you than you can bear. The friends of Job, Eliphaz, Zophar, and Bildad, are going to give their best shot at comforting Job as he's sitting in an ash heap, scraping his boils with broken pottery. And Eliphaz speaks first. That's Job chapters 4 and 5. He begins at the beginning of chapter 4 pointing out the good that Job had done. But as he continues, he doesn't comfort Job for a couple of reasons. First of all, in his limited wisdom and understanding, didn't realize this was a unique case. And so at the end of chapter 4, Eliphaz is going to remind Job, guess who's punished? Sinners. But this book begins, the first verse of this book, Job 1 verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil. A couple of verses later, at the end of verse 3, so this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. And yet here he sits, lost everything but his wife, who of course, you can imagine how hopeless she felt for her husband. She just asked him to curse God and die, chapter 2, verse 9. And now his good friend Eliphaz seems to think that he's a philosopher who had all the explanations for Job's situation all worked out, and he had no idea what was really taking place. This was a unique situation. And secondly, he didn't comfort because he showed no real heartfelt sympathy. He's basically saying, Job, it's all going to work out after God gets through disciplining you for your sin. Look at verse 17, chapter 5, verse 17. Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, do not despise the chastening of the Almighty. For he bruises, but he binds up. He wounds, but his hands make whole. He shall deliver you in six troubles. Yes, in seven, no evil shall touch you. Again, he's simply saying, after God gets through punishing you, everything will be okay. In chapter 15, Eliphaz continued with the very same approach. He really believed, he understood all the ways God dealt with men. Eliphaz, in fact, got his feelings hurt when Job didn't acknowledge his superior insight and wisdom. And in chapter 22, he continues to miss the mark because he could only see one single aspect of how God deals with mankind. He thought he had it all figured out. Do you think you have it all figured out? I don't. I don't think I've got it all figured out, but he did. And this is what he figured out. If a man sins, God will punish him. And he was the kind of man who would look at Jesus hanging on the cross and say, well, he must have sinned because God's punishing him. Now, Bildad, the second one, also makes three attempts to comfort Job. He didn't appreciate, Job didn't appreciate what Eliphaz had assumed was Job's problem, sin. And Bildad is going to be even more misguided and hurtful. Look at chapter 8, verse 1. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, how long will you speak these things, and the words of your mouth be like a strong wind? Does God subvert judgment? Or does the Almighty pervert justice? If your sons have sinned against him, he has cast them away for their transgression. You get what he's saying there? If you would earnestly seek God and make your supplication to the Almighty, if you were pure and upright, surely now he would awake for you and prosper your rightful dwelling place. In other words, you are in this mess because of your sin. And in chapters 18 and in chapter 25, he just keeps hammering away at Job, completely insensitive to all of Job's replies. In other words, he wasn't hearing a word Job was saying. Now, the third one, Zophar, he takes his turn. By then, Job had to be thinking, boy, with friends like this, I don't need any enemies. Look at chapter 11, verse 1. Then Zophar, the Naamathite, answered and said, should not the multitude of words be answered? And should a man full of talk be vindicated? And should a man full of, should your empty talk make men hold their peace? And when you mock, should no one rebuke you? Notice what he's accusing him of? You're mocking God. For you've said, my doctrine is pure, and I'm clean in your eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against you, that he would show you the secrets of wisdom, for they would double your prudence. Know therefore that God exacts from you less than your iniquity deserves. In other words, if you got what you really deserved, it'd be so much worse. And then Elihu throws his two cents in. The young man is telling Job, Job, you really need to listen to these guys. And even he even condemned Job for questioning God. And he let Job know that God was not to be blamed for his pain. It was Job's sin that caused this discomfort. And so the book of Job powerfully directs us with a don't do it this way. This book tells us how to not attempt to comfort someone. So how do we comfort those who are hurting? First of all, we've got to remember our own limitations. Remember Paul quoting the Old Testament in Romans 3 verse 10? That you'll recognize this. There's none righteous? No, not one. And so as we approach anyone who is hurting, we can't forget that when it comes to the Bible, we're not the expert. We're always the student. We're always learning. And when we feel the temptation to be the expert, to do all the explaining, and end up really looking down on others, here's what we need to learn from the Bible. It's time to get off your high horse and humble yourselves before the Lord. Why? You're not righteous. You're not God. There's none righteous. No, not one. And so, never forget your limitations. Secondly, we have to strive to relate to the feelings of others. If you make no attempt to understand, that's not going to be a secret to the one you're attempting to comfort. If you're insincere, it'll always shine through. So does apathy. If you don't really care, you can't fake your way along very far. But you can do this. Romans 12, verse 15. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. You can do that. Obviously, you can't rejoice or weep with those if you're not there for them and with them. And if you have no intention of relating to that hurt, they won't hear a peep from you. They might hear the sounds, but there won't be a message they receive in their hearts. Because relating to others, listen to me, relating to others is at the heart of comforting others. Thirdly, we have to remember that every person is unique in the sight of God. If you mistreat them, Jesus taught us this, you're mistreating me. If you help them, you're helping me. And every individual is just that. It's an individual, different from all others. That's why Jesus was so effective with people, especially the outcast. He treated them all as special beings created by God. And so we have to approach people that way. Everyone's unique in the sight of God. Fourthly, we have to remember there's no substitute for genuine, active, heartfelt sympathy. You've heard the word sympathy and the word empathy. And those two words are interesting because they're just a little bit different. Sympathy is a shared feeling, usually of sorrow or pity or compassion for someone else. You show concern for another person when you feel sympathy for them. You haven't experienced what they're experiencing, but your heart hurts for them. You feel sorrowful for them. Empathy is stronger than sympathy, because empathy is literally the ability to put yourself in place of someone else, because you've been there. You've been there. You've walked in their shoes. And so, understand someone else's feelings. You can do that because you're feeling that with them. You've been there. So, let's illustrate. So, if someone has fallen into the well and they're yelling and they get your attention, sympathy might look down in the well and say, "Oh, no. I'm so sorry that you're at the bottom of this well." Now, here's one of the weaknesses of sympathy. Sympathy will try, oftentimes, to put a silver lining on the cloud. Well, at least you're not dead. And you're not out in the sun. You're not having to live out here in this brutal sunlight beating down on you continually. And you have plenty of water to drink. Sympathy often comes with those silver clouds. Well, this has happened to you, but look how much, look, the good things. Empathy is different. Empathy drives you to find a ladder, crawl down to the bottom of the well. You feel no need to comfort them with some silver lining by offering some ridiculous pseudo wisdom. You just want to connect. No goofy words needed. And you go to the bottom of the well and you embrace them and you weep with them as they weep, and then you are at their side as they make their way out of the well. There's no substitute for that. That's ministry. Now, obviously, some people, there's no solutions. It's not just as simple as climbing out of a well. But you're there. You're connecting. That's ministry. That's the heart of ministry. You're connecting. And then lastly, how do we help them? We remember the value. Actually, there's going to be one more. But fifthly, we have to remember the value of silent sharing. So what? Silent sharing. And this goes hand in hand with connecting with someone. When was Job most comforted by his friends? 7 days and seven nights. No one said a word, but he sat there with them at his side. At the ash heap. 7 days, seven nights. That got messed up when they started talking. Magic words to remove all the hurt or to explain all the reason for the tragedy are not needed. They're not even realistic. Being there is what's important. Nothing's more powerful than that. Being there. I've had people tell me that they would visit the grieving, but I don't know what to say. Words are not needed. Words are not needed. Except, I love you. I'm praying for you. And be there. Words are not. Your presence says it all. Now, lastly, remember that God has unlimited resources. We don't. Please, are you listening? Please, 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 please don't try to explain why this terrible thing has happened. Don't do that. You don't know why this has happened. You're limited. God isn't. In other words, don't play God. Well, you know, this... No, no. That doesn't comfort anyone. In 45 years of ministry, I've made some really, really close, dear friends. And many of them were not friends I went and fished with or hunted or, you know, did recreational things. Or the closest ones were the ones I was with during the toughest days of grief and struggle and the best days of celebration. I often talk about, yeah, that family, I've done a lot of marrying and burying in that family. That's my way of saying I've been through the hard times with them, preached the funerals, and then I got to preach the weddings. This is how being like Christ works. You're expected to be there and to be a servant. I'll never forget when I was preaching in Allen, Oklahoma, there was a person who wasn't from Allen that passed away, but they were bringing that person back to Allen for the funeral. And there was a mortician. He was from northeastern Oklahoma. I don't remember which town he was from. But I've never forgotten him. And he and I sat and visited a long time, and he had to be one of the more effective morticians I've ever known. He told me a story. He said, actually, Danny, this has happened many times, but recently he had walked into a home. Someone had lost a loved one, and he walked in the house to make funeral arrangements. Instead of them coming to him, he went to them. And he said, when I walked in, the door was open. I just walked in. No one was in the living room. There were people in the house, but no one's in the living room. And he said the place was a disaster area. And he said, I walked straight to the kitchen. The cabinets were piled with dishes. The sink was full of dishes. He said it was a huge mess. He said, I took off my tie, I took off my coat, I rolled up my sleeves, and I started washing dishes. And he said, I cleaned until I got everything cleaned up. I'll never forget that. He didn't look like the kind of guy that would clean up a kitchen in a living room. He didn't look like that. He looked like a mortician with his suit and tie on. But he understood how to comfort people. And it's never done with magic words. It's done with loving presence. And as you can imagine, I have no doubt people loved and admired that man in his hometown, because he understood how to comfort by simply being there with people and for people, serving them in any way that he could. So that's my lesson on do's and don'ts of helping others. Forget magic words, just be there. If you need to come, please come now while we stand and sing.